What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Lisa Forestell. Lisa is the Director of Community Development at the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. Lisa is a voice hearer and an activist and psychiatric survivor, and she's a group facilitator and trainer of Hearing Voices groups and Alternatives to Suicide groups. So welcome to Madness Radio, Lisa Forestell.
Thanks for having me, Will.
Lisa, I know you're very involved with the Hearing Voices movement in the U.S. and internationally. I just want to congratulate you on all the work that's being done with the Hearing Voices Congress, which is coming up soon in Boston.
Thanks a lot. We're getting really, really beyond excited about it. It's been 2 years in the making at this point. And I thought I was excited when we took the project on, and I just get a little more so every day. So we're really looking forward to welcoming the international crowd to U.S. shores for the first time.
Yeah, the Hearing Voices movement is a whole international effort to change the way that psychiatry and society respond to these experiences. We're going to be talking about the organizing and the work of the Hearing Voices movement on the show. And I just want to start out by asking you about your own experiences. How did you first realize that you were a voice hearer? How did you get involved in the psychiatric system? And what was it that led you to go on to become an activist and advocate and trainer?
Oh, boy. That is a huge question. The first part is I've always been a voice hearer, but I didn't realize I was a voice hearer. So I've heard voices for as long as I have memory. And I think at that time, I thought everybody had voices similar to mine. So I didn't think anything of it at all until I started interacting with folks with bodies that found my friendships with my voices unsettling. So that happened. That happened in elementary school, you know, as I started to get into school. So my family was fairly receptive, or thought that I had little friends or whatever, you know, however they explained it. But I started getting pushback from folks outside of our family when I went to school.
So it wasn't really a problem when you first had it, and when you were a kid. It was really when you got out into the larger society. Your family was very accepting, and just, this was okay. This is normal. This is considered just fine.
Yeah, I was actually overseas. My father had been stationed overseas. My entire family was over there, really during a developmental phase in my life. I was, you know, a toddler, acquiring language and friendships, but my friendships were with my voices. And so it was kind of lonely there because everybody else spoke Thai. So I also have kind of a bilingual relationship with my voices because we speak both Thai and English, and sometimes other languages that I don't claim ownership of, but that happens anyway. And they know that I don't. But when I came back to the States, it was really reinforced that my relationship with my voices was not okay, that it was going to interfere with my education. I really got teased by the other kids. And so it was really a harsh reckoning.
Well, help us to understand what it is that you're experiencing. So you're a kid, and you're having like imaginary friends that you hear and then you speak to, and then you hear them talk back to you. Or how is your voice hearing experience?
Well, I've never really considered them imaginary. I've just accepted them as a part of my experience. And so I don't, even now, I don't necessarily have the words to really truly describe them. I usually use the word companion because I think other folks get that. And there is an aspect of the three voices that I hear most predominantly that have chosen to be with me, which I think companion describes well. But I have three voices predominantly. I also have visual and tactile things that happen for me, which are also kind of within the hearing voices realm that other people don't experience. And sometimes I just kind of have an entire either out-of-body experience or extrasensory experience that other folks don't share. But my primary day-to-day experience, they are here with me right now, are my three companions.
Are they? Can we welcome them on the show? Are they listening in? Are they talking to you now?
They are definitely listening in. They tend to be quiet while I'm talking to other folks. And as I tell my story, I think you'll understand why that is. But they're definitely listening and actually tittered a little bit at being welcomed. So thanks very much.
Oh, well, maybe we can hear more from them later on in the show. And I guess this really underscores that there's really a huge diversity to both what people experience as voice hearing and also the language that they use. And so some people like one word, some people like a different word. Some people have experiences that are also visual, that also involve sensation and tactile experiences. Other people don't. And so tell us more about what that is for you and who are these three companions?
I'm going to flash forward real quick because I really want to offer this story. I was doing a training, a hearing voices training, and I offered my testimony about what my experience is personally. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you are so lucky to know your three spirits. And this person had a belief system whereby all of us are assigned and have three spirits that walk through life with us. And she was just joyous that I knew mine so well. I so appreciated that framework because the idea that my companions are on this journey with me is very much how I believe what's going on for me. And I'd never, ever thought of them as spirits because I really do think of them very much like I do my corporeal friends. If you have a body, you stand with me like my companions, my voices. So it was a really cool story to hear. And every once in a while, one of my voices will say something in just such a way that it feels very much like a predestined partnership that the four of us are on.
So these are very supportive companions. These are like friends. These are helpers. These are really sort of part of your family in a sense.
They are. And just like family, we get into rows and, you know, have it out every once in a while. But for the most part, they're some of my most trusted souls. They're very important to me.
Can you give us an example of the kinds of things that they say or how your interactions are, what kinds of visual and tactile connections that you make with them, or if they're listening and they want to share some things, they're welcome to?
Sure. Voice hearers, like you said, have just a myriad of different experiences, and some folks will hear voices from parts of their body and inside of their body, and other folks will hear them from outside of their body. And then just very, very different, you know, one single voice can have many different voices or different ways to offer themselves. My voices, I hear exclusively from outside of my body. It can be from different distances. It is through my ears, and they tend to hover. Again, that spiritual illusion really, really held a lot of sway for me because I don't usually visualize my voices as standing on the ground. They're hovering and they're with me. One is male and two are female. When we were little, we were all the same age. The male decided to grow up with me, so he's in his 50s like I am, and the girls decided to stay young, and so they help me hold my childlike curiosity. They play with me. They love to sing to me, and they just kind of help me out. I don't know, staying in touch with a bit of the vitality that's hard to stay in touch with as you grow older. And my male voice keeps it real. He keeps it 100. He does so in some crass ways sometimes, but when we found out about the hearing voices movement, we had closeted our experience for 40 years, I think, by that time. And that was our response to being told that we weren't welcome in school.
How did that happen in school? Did you just start telling people that you had these companions and then you got judgment and criticism, or what happened?
I didn't have any filter. So it didn't occur to me that other people weren't talking out loud to people that weren't there. So it was strange because I would share, you know, oh, so, you know, one of my voices just says such and such. I had learned to translate for my voices and share in the moment, but it hadn't occurred to me that people weren't doing that back. And so it was made pretty clear to me very quickly. And like I said, it was the teachers' comments around it affecting my school, my education, and just not something that should be in the classroom. And looking back, I think she was quite frightened.
Was there any real evidence that it was affecting your class participation negatively, or was it just a fear that the teachers had?
There was absolutely no evidence. So yeah, it was a fear, or a need for control, or, I can't speak for what was happening for her, but, the result was we had a meeting, my voices and I, and we decided that, my voices would not talk to me when I was with people that had bodies. They were allowed to hang out and observe, but they wouldn't talk to me, and that I wouldn't talk to them either, and that we would have time when we had alone time. And so we closeted ourselves in kindergarten. We stayed that way. So although I had interaction with the mental health system, I suffered a rape in college and was diagnosed because that was actually traumatic and I had a response to it. I became a mental health patient for, you know, the next 30 years or so as a result of that. But I never reported to them my voice hearing. It is in my charts. When I was in the hospital, I think it was observed by a couple folks, but I never said that it was something that I experienced or something that I wanted help around. And when I was on a medication that muffled my voices, I would talk myself off of that medication or stop taking it so I could hear my voices.
So you learned to really go underground with this experience as a way of protecting yourself at a very early age, it sounds like.
Really. And so the consequences of that particular teacher, while I think she inadvertently probably helped protect me, like I would have just had that conversation over and over again with folks as they, I don't know, everybody continued to think I was odd and a bit outside of everything, but
what do you think teachers in the school system should do instead if they encounter a kid that's talking to these voices or companions that other people aren't seeing or hearing?
I think that a lot of again, this is my very, very personal opinion, that the schools need to stop trying to create automatons, and they should be curious about the uniqueness of the individual students they have in the room, whatever that student presents. Be curious about it. Find out more about what that is. Normalize that experience for whatever, you know, whether it's around poverty, around race, around experiences that other kids don't have, around being the new kid in school, whatever that is, validating that it's a real and true experience for kids will get them a lot farther than trying to get them to glued to their seats.
Do you think that would have really benefited you if you had encountered that kind of a response instead of this judgment and something's wrong that forced you to go into the closet with the experience?
I think so. When Facebook became a thing and I started reconnecting with kids that I'd been through elementary through high school with, or, you know, somewhere in there, there was a communication chain where everybody referred to me as shy. And I thought about it and I thought, wow, I think I am a bit shy, but I think it's more protective, and that's how I responded. And my memory of school is not that I was shy. You know, I was part of the theater troupe, and, you know, I did all kinds of things. And it was really interesting to see that the perspective of my fellow classmates was that I was very quiet and shy.
So you kind of withdrew a little bit from the social participation as part of having to hide this part of yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
And what about your parents in all this? Did they sort of see that they were having difficulties in school, or were you still open about your companions at home, or how did that work?
We made a full closet of it. We put it all away. So it would be when I was out hiking around by myself that I was with my voices, or in my room alone. I also learned to be really, really good about talking to them without using verbal communication. So I can talk without speaking out loud to them. And that is by and large how I communicate with them to this day. So, my voice is, so when we were closeted, my male voice, which was growing up with me and therefore kind of experiencing teenage angst and all that stuff along with me, would just take the stage when I got home and when I was in a place where there weren't people around. And I would be obliged to hear every thought he'd had throughout the whole day. And he would just like, he would load it on me.
What kinds of thoughts? Like he would be angry or frightened or?
During that time in particular, but even to this day, I think he has great insight. But at that time, it just felt voyeuristic. He would say, well, so-and-so really meant such-and-such when they said such-and-such. And, you know, he would get catty and just say, you know, don't trust that one as far as you can throw them. And why did you screw up that test, you know, number 7 on the test? Because I know you knew that one. Like he just couldn't be contained. And I felt that way too a lot. And so even though it felt like a lot to hear from him all at once, I think that's how I felt too. Like he was almost a reflection of not feeling like there was enough time in the day to express the person he was becoming.
So he had his own reactions, but they're very closely related to your reactions and emotions, but he's just more expressive about them.
You know, they were totally different perception, but we both were experiencing this, you know, how can we be more out there? How can we be more ourselves? And I think a lot of teens have that going on, you know, we're just like, I tried out for a school play and, I got a really, really great lead role in it. And he just kept pushing me and pushing me. He's like, if you don't feel like you're stepping off the edge of that stage, you're not working hard enough. You just got to put it all out there. And I don't care. I will hold you when you get home and you need to cry about it. You're going to put it all out there. So he was a cheerleader sometimes. He was critical. He was a bit obnoxious sometimes. Like he was just all these things and a best friend because he had chosen to grow up with me. He was seeing the world that I was living through a pretty unique perspective because he was right there with me the whole time.
So you really see him as his own person, that he's his own independent self. He's just doesn't have a body.
Yep. Absolutely.
What about the two girls? How were they relating to you when you were growing up? They stayed the same age, it sounds like.
Yeah, they stayed the same age. And the way they reacted to my growing up sometimes was becoming insular themselves. So they would decide that they could only depend on each other because they really got each other. And so sometimes they would kind of push away from me during those years. They would not be as available to me as he was because we were having such different experiences. And I would have to work a little extra hard. I have to let him wear himself out. And then I'd have to, oh, he didn't like that comment, by the way. Anyway.
Okay. What does he say about, I'm curious, what does he say about that? Does he want to jump in with his own opinions? We're talking about him a lot, it sounds like.
Yeah, I have complete permission to talk about him, but he says he gets to comment as well.
Okay.
And the comment that he made, I can't say on radio.
Oh, but okay.
But the girls, I needed to care for them and help them know that they were important and that they were necessary. Like I needed to do a little bit more work with them when I got involved with theater. And I wasn't like a theater rat like the whole time I was in school, but for this is what's occurring to me now. So for theater, having them help me learn the lyrics and my lines, they would help me by playing the other roles that I was on stage in, that kind of stuff. They loved doing that. And that pulled them back in at a time that they were feeling like maybe they were missing out on a lot.
So it's really like kind of growing up as a family of close companions and going through life together.
Yeah. It's like I said, it's something that I diligently protect. And part of that comes from feeling like we needed to closet ourselves for so long, but most of it has to do with the value that I place on the relationship that I have with them.
And you said that you also have some visual and tactile experiences with them. Can you tell us about that?
Not so much with them. It's just that I have them. So there are times where I have sensory perceptions of probably, I always say scarabs underneath my skin. It's usually a time when I'm under great stress and having a fair amount of difficulty. So that's a really not so pleasant experience that I have. I do think it's been associated with the different psychiatric medications that I've been on in the past, because it doesn't occur hardly at all now, and I've moved away from the use of a lot of those drugs that I was on in the past. So that was an experience that happened fairly frequently for about 20 years or so. And it's changed into more of a visual thing now, although the scarab thing is still part of it. It's not as pervasive. And the visual stuff happens very, very, it's different all the time. And one story that I share has to do, in the work that I do, I tend to work a lot out of my car, and I'm going from one destination to another quite frequently to hang with our community. And I was doing one such commute of an hour and a half or more, and it had been the end of a long day. And as I came up over the crest of the hill, I saw a puddle and then like a small lake of blood spilling out onto the road in front of me. And I explain it as kind of like a sun mirage on a hot day. It kind of ripples across other folks experience the sun mirages. For me, it was blood. And as I came up on it, I would be filled with anxiety, even though I was comparing it to that mirage. And I was like, I'm pretty sure it's going to go away and I'll be fine. But this was happening day after day, always at the end of the day, not on my original commute, but on my commute home. And it got petrifying. I couldn't drive through the blood. I had concerns about the blood sticking to my tires and pulling me under. It was absolutely terrifying. So it got so bad that I couldn't do it. And I drove, I don't know, after a week or two of this, this final time, I pulled over and just kind of screamed and wept and did all the things you do when you just can't take it anymore. I don't even know how long I was there. But it relented. And when I opened up my eyes, it had all dried to a really hard red desert-like, complete with cracks and everything. And so it felt like I limped my car over it to get home. I took myself off the road for a couple weeks after that, because along with that visual input, I really felt like I wanted to die. There was a lot of concern for me about making an instantaneous decision around my own death. So I took myself off the road and just kind of allowed myself to decompress in a lot of ways, and came to understand it again, hindsight and just time to sit with stuff. I now understand that as my concern for my world and wanting to change things in my role as an advocate and activist. And at the end of the day, while I may have done a bunch of things heading in that direction that I hope, my world of change, I wasn't doing enough. There were still people locked up. There were still people in pain. There were still people facing impending homelessness or, you know, whatever had gone on that day. And I was feeling ineffectual and like I couldn't do enough.
So the vision that you had was related to that sense of not being able to do enough.
Yeah.
It's interesting that these two experiences are more on the negative end of things, but the companions are very positive. What do you kind of make of that? I mean, some people have voices that are very negative and are attacking them or judging them or, really, really causing very distracting them a lot or causing them a lot of distress. But for you, it's been more of a positive experience, it sounds like. What do you make of that?
I kind of have my own understanding for myself, but it makes me a lot more curious about other folks. I want to know what other people think of it. And, you know, based on their experience, especially if their experience has been very different than my own. So I love to talk to folks about why we've responded different to kind of some similar things. Oftentimes we have really different frameworks in which we understand those things. And that has, I think, influenced how we've been able to respond in the moment.
Do you think that the way that it was kind of normalized all from the very beginning in your family sort of kept it in a kind of a positive frame for you?
I do. I think I never placed any negativity on it, even if my voices and I were squabbling and, you know, I wanted to go tell mommy to put them in the corner or whatever was happening for me as a child. It was normal and anger was okay and loving was okay. And all the myriad of emotions that we have in relationship, they were all okay, especially with my voices, because there wasn't anybody else witnessing it. It was just us. And so there was no policing of human emotion. And so that became like pristine and really special for me as I grew up.
So that was part of your childhood, was having a pretty supportive family childhood, would you say, that there was a sort of an acceptance of emotions? And
I wish that was true. I think actually my parents were pretty busy and didn't have a lot of time to notice. They actually are kind of, you know, they came up through the 50s and were raised by, you know, folks that were born in the teens and 20s or thereabout. And so they were a bit on the authoritarian side, and children should be seen and not heard. And they definitely had a ton of pressure that they were operating under, trying to figure out life. And so I think I was left to my own devices. And because I was becoming a quiet child anyway, as long as I was quiet, they weren't trying to influence who I was talking to or anything like that. So it was strangely accepting, just because they didn't, as long as I was quiet, it was good.
So you were kind of given the space to just accept yourself and have a kind of a loving attitude towards your own emotions, it sounds like.
Well, definitely. But at the same time, I don't know, it's kind of weird, because at the same time, I still to this day have this sense that I have a different operating system than other people, and I don't quite understand other people. I think a lot of people that hear voices mention, like at some point in their journey with their voices, they felt as though they were an alien or a monster or something, because they feel so separate or other from other people that don't have that experience. And that's certainly been my experience as well. So it's really complex. And
well, that's the question I think a lot of people are maybe asking, is what's your belief about why you have these companions and maybe other people don't? And a kind of like a psychologist might say, oh, these are parts of yourself that are split off and they're separate and they're actually inside of your head, but you're imagining that they're companions and you're imagining that they're outside. They're not really real. They're just sort of parts of yourself. That would be maybe a conventional perspective. But what's your perspective on why you have these experiences and what they're about?
I actually know quite a few people that do feel that explains their voice hearing. For me, that works up into a point. I do think that a lot of the ways that I walk through my world are very much influenced by the trauma that I've experienced and the learning that I've had along my journey. But because these voices have been with me for as long as I can remember, quite frankly, prior to my first memories of trauma, like my first memory of trauma, it's really weird because it's another sexual abuse memory, and it was when I was probably 3 years old, and we were in Thailand, and the voices are already there, and I have a very distinct memory that they were already there. And they were already supportive. And although I have a memory of a very awful thing that happened to me, my voices were already there.
That is something that the Hearing Voices movement has suggested. And I think it maybe is true for a lot of people, that the trauma happens and then the voices come as a response to the trauma. And you're saying that actually for you, that's not so much an explanation that fits.
It doesn't explain my voices. I think it does explain something like the pool of blood, the lake of blood in the road. And so I start to think more about maybe I'm just more open to hearing things or seeing things that others don't. So there's you know, theory around that too, that there's different accesses in our brain that people have available to them that some other folks don't, or whatever that is. I definitely identify pretty strongly with the idea of a trauma model, with the exception of my voices being a part of me. I don't think they are. They're separate souls that are on a journey with me.
So coming back to the story, you have to go into the closet at an early age with your companions. You go through school, and then this terrible tragedy happens with the rape, and you said that really brought you into the psychiatric system. But you, at that time, you also kept hidden from the psychiatric system these experiences of your companions. So what happened to you when you started to be part of mental health treatment?
I was given an antidepressant that I think actually kind of triggered like a mania of sorts. So I started to get a heaped on pile of diagnoses that really should have, I don't know, I think I should have had some sort of episodic interaction with the mental health system as they supported me through the trauma of physical violence that I'd undergone. But instead I got pulled into the system. I was convinced that I needed to realign my goals and my expectations of what my life could be. And I was really off balance. You know, the world had treated me in some pretty harsh ways, and I really believed that the mental health system knew what they were doing and that they could help me and that they wouldn't be telling me things that just weren't true.
So you sort of internalized the diagnosis. You started to see yourself as the way you were labeled.
I did. I mean, it all made sense. I struggled coming out of the last years of college because college had been pretty hard on me. And prior to that, I thought I was going to be a lifelong student. And so when a psychiatrist said, you need to realign your goals, I was like, well, that makes sense. I struggled so hard. I must not be able to do this.
Wow. To realign your goals, that means telling you that you're not capable, that you really need to just scale back your dreams about who you want to be in the world, sounds like.
Well, at the same time, the guy that raped me, was never, I don't even think he was interviewed by the police. Nothing happened. So that I think the idea of fairness and justice plays very strongly for me, you know, and I think even at that, the initial diagnosis was a relief for me because I didn't know what was going on for me. And it was good to have somebody telling me. And I don't think I realized that, it was also incredibly limiting, and really, really harming. So, yeah. And there was enough going on in the rest of my world that I needed to just be able to rely on something because the rest of the world wasn't making very much sense.
How did you get out of that framework of seeing yourself through the diagnostic lens? And what role did your companions play in that process?
I think we were all trying to figure it out. But I pretty much ran the gambit of being a professional mental health patient. I wanted to find the right pill. I wanted to, find the right protocol or training or some way to fix me. I was very, very focused and very compliant around being fixed. And you can only do that for so many years before you realize that the folks trying to fix you really don't know much more than you do. And that the interventions they're using are harmful. So I was 80 pounds heavier than I needed to be and really stuck in my bedroom. I couldn't really leave my bedroom. And I was living such a limited existence that really my only ongoing conversation, and it very much involved my voices, was around my own death and wondering whether or not they would go on if I didn't, and what was on the other side of death.
You were wondering if your companions would continue and be okay if you died in exactly the same way that someone might worry about if their family or their friends would be okay if they, or their pets, if they died.
And that's exactly what my conversation was, because I was most concerned about my children and my voices. How would they be if I stopped existing?
They became a reason to live, it sounds like.
Yeah, although my male voice honestly was willing to be very philosophical about it, and he is to this day. Like, we have really interesting conversations around kind of the existentialism of life and death. And so that was his preferred conversation. You know, he liked to really get involved in that. But the girls were terrified at the thought of my not being around any longer. And it was so helpful to hear from them, because I couldn't actually entertain this with my children. You know, I couldn't talk about it with them. So hearing from my girls, from that visceral place where I might be identified in kind of a maternal way sometimes, was really important to hear from. And they helped me to figure out that it wasn't necessarily death that I was talking about. It was circumstance, and that was what needed to change. So I ended my marriage, which was also many years. You know, that's a great big old kettle of fish right there. But moving out of that house that had really trapped me, along with all these other identities that had been forced on me over the years, was a great big turning point for me. My voices came with me. They didn't have to pack much. And eventually my two youngest children came with me too. And now, you know, the kids are all grown and I'm still on the planet. And that just kept me moving away from the mental health system. So I had a therapist that I felt that I was in a trusting relationship with. So I maintained that relationship. And although I never did tell him about my voices either, until the very end when I decided that it was time to go do something else. But yeah, it was a slow movement away. I know a lot of folks in the world that I wander through now that are truly non-compliant, and at different times have just said no, and variations of that, sometimes much more flowery. And I don't feel like I ever did that. And sometimes I wonder what would have happened if I had. But it's been reflected back to me that I was non-compliant, that I was not willing to keep doing the same old thing and not expect a different outcome. And I was almost entirely off the psychotropic medication before I made the final cut with psychiatry and the mental health world, with their knowledge, but with my insistence. And I was using human rights policies and things to make sure that I had some autonomy around it.
Was it just because the medications weren't working and it wasn't helpful to you and the side effects, or what was it that led you to get off of the psychotropics?
I think that's primarily what it is. I had gained a vast amount of weight, and that affected how I could be in my world. And I'm an avid alpine skier, which is really hard to do when you're really heavy. And that's coming from somebody who skied through her pregnancies and everything else. And so it was really nice to get back in shape, and that helped a lot just coming off the medications.
And Lisa, was your first contact with the Hearing Voices movement, was it through the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community?
It was. They had some contact across the pond, as it were, and through colleges in the area to really find a home for Hearing Voices on the shores here in the U.S. It had taken hold in different pockets of the U.S., but never really set roots. And I'm so thankful that they committed their resources to providing the group that I started attending, to providing the training that helped me become a facilitator, to providing this avenue by which I've really, and my male voice, have really found a passion and kind of a faded existence. So that was just hugely important. It's part of this long piece that my voice has around changing the world. So,
Lisa, one of the things that you do now is that you facilitate Hearing Voices groups, and you're a trainer in Hearing Voices groups and a big part of the Hearing Voices movement. Tell us something about the kinds of ways that people learn to live with their voices, the kinds of things that you're working with people in the groups, how the groups are helpful to people, and sort of how they work for people who don't know about the Hearing Voices movement.
Yeah, so Hearing Voices groups are very much like how I wish school was, where people would be curious about each other's experience and who they are and how they form their opinions of the world. And that's what Hearing Voices groups are. And they become these sacred spaces where we can talk about things that really we don't have permission to talk about anywhere else in our lives. I should say that my voices and I were really, really pessimistic about the Hearing Voices movement. And I watched it for a couple years before I started to interact with it, and then felt like I was kicking the tires of a used vehicle. Like, I really didn't trust it. And that my male voice, when we decided to come out during that conversation, he said, you know, he actually said, it's my fate that we do Hearing Voices work. This is why I'm here. So I think, you know, it's kind of a pack deal and we're all in it, but he particular in and of himself feels as though he's fated to be a part of the Hearing Voices movement and be a part of bringing Hearing Voices to the US. So that happened, back in 2008 or 9 or so. And since then I've pretty much been, just really eager to learn as much as I can about the Hearing Voices movement, to be a part of the Hearing Voices USA network here in the US and part of Intervoice internationally. And then just being a part of these beautiful sacred spaces where we talk about what works and what doesn't work and why. We talk with each other's voices. We talk about different steps that we've taken in relationship building with our voices. We have fun little tactics that give us a break, not only from our voices, but oftentimes from other relationships that we have in our lives. I've been a part of the movement long enough that technology has been a huge part of those tactics. So when I was first a member of Hearing Voices groups, we would share, you know, you should get one of those Bluetooth things and put it in your ear, and then you can say anything you want and everybody will think you're on the phone. But now it's almost as though if you're quiet, people think you're odd because everybody's talking to somebody that's not there, because the technology has, you know, eclipsed. And so now in groups, we don't talk about that so much because there's actually a strange element of technology that has made voice hearers that talk out loud to their voices more comfortable in some situations than they would have been otherwise. I tend, in my communications with my voices, I am more animated than I am when I talk with other people. And so I have to check that. And so that's been my experience when I'm talking with other folks too, is that we have to tone it down. but otherwise, we can, I'm throwing air quotes, we can get away with a lot more than we used to be able to. And little by little, and this does my heart good, is more and more people in the United States know about the Hearing Voices movement and at least have an inkling or a curiosity around the experience being something other than a mental health illness or connected with some sort of disease or disorder process. So it is pretty easy for me now to start a conversation, and somebody will quickly want to ally themselves with me, and they'll say, oh yeah, I heard my mom calling my name 3 weeks after she passed, rather than saying, you're one of those folks and, you know, do you see a psychiatrist? So that conversation has been changing too. But really, the groups are amazing because even if we're not talking about voice hearing in particular, the camaraderie that is developed and being able to leave that space and still know that you're not alone in the world, that there are other people that have similar experiences that are so unique that you can't wait to get back to that group and find out more about that person, is kind of life-giving in a way that I didn't expect.
That was certainly something that I experienced, is just the focal point for finding friendship. The Hearing Voices movement and doing this work with the Icarus Project and Freedom Center and Psychiatric Survivors, it really has given me this huge meditation on the idea that experiences happen for a reason. There's a purpose. One of my first realizations about one of the voices that I have was that it wasn't just a angry voice that was after me. And when I started to listen to it, I discovered it had a gender. It was a male voice. And then I recognized it was my father's voice. And so for a long time, I really just felt just persecuted by, okay, I got my father's stuck in my head now. I've got this voice that's attacking me. I started to learn about, well, the idea that the voice is a messenger and that there's some reason. And I couldn't really get it until I started to think about the framework of trauma and bullying, and to realize that, you know, bullying was something that happened to me a lot in my life. So I was trying to understand, well, what is this that could actually be the message or positive? In a way, having that bully that I'm interacting with as a voice kind of has this message of wake up and start to stand up for yourself and get some strength. And that's how I've used that voice as a way of propelling my own personal development and growth. And so a lot of my talking with that voice is like talking back to a bully. Hey, don't talk to me like that. Actually, I'm a good person. I deserve to be treated well. If you've got some message and there's something here, okay, but don't be so mean to me. And also just seeing how this thread of powerlessness existed so much in my life when I was a young man, just growing up and finding my own voice. And so having that inner struggle with this voice hearing experience really helped to strengthen me and help to learn and grow. And so now I can kind of get it. Okay, yeah, there is, even in this painful, negative, persecuting voice that I was hearing, there was this deeper message and purpose that I was able to grab a hold of. And I think the Hearing Voices movement really helped to encourage me. And it took many years of work and understanding, but I think the Hearing Voices movement was really important in that for me.
Yeah. And you find that you develop your own sense of compassion. Like you can look at the bully and you can see the hurt that has happened to the bully as well. And the protective pieces that the bully might be offering in their own aggression.
Well, that took a long time with my dad because I went through a lot of real just anger with him. Actually, you know, it was really, I had to kind of get to that place of compassion gradually through the anger.
Oh, I hear you. Because I think I've been lucky in that my male voice has never been, he's never been the abusive person. He's often modeled or offer the same messages as the abusive person. And because he's not the same person, my curiosity led me to, why are you saying that way? And are you hurt too? I would ask him questions because he was essentially an actor putting on a character for me, and I needed to know his motivation. And so he would, you know, and so I haven't necessarily been able to do that with some of the people in my life that necessarily he's represented over the years. But I have a lot of compassion for them, even if I've chosen to distance myself from them, or, you know, however I've managed the situation. He's really helped me make space for them, even if the relationship between us is not great. And a lot of voice hearers find that if, especially with abusive voices, if they can be curious and ask questions about why that voice is treating them the way that they are, that they do get a lot of insight around what's going on for them. And it doesn't mean that things are going to be rosy moving forward, but that the perspective just becomes more three-dimensional and different bridges are created.
People are so often just, you know, running away or not having any curiosity or just wanting to obliterate or distract or just get away, which is sometimes what's needed. I mean, sometimes you just need a break or you just need to somehow fill your head with something other than the voice you're hearing. But I think in general, that's a very positive approach that psychiatry often doesn't have, of curiosity, compassion, trying to understand the reasons behind things, exploring, having some real listening. And that, I think, is one of the great gifts of the Hearing Voices groups, is that they are this listening space for curiosity. And no one's preaching one interpretation, that there's many, many different interpretations. It's more of a platform and a vehicle for discovery and exploration and learning from each other, as well as being a hub for community building. I wanted to ask your voices if they've been listening to all of this and what they might want to add, if they have anything else that they want to contribute to all this different perspective and points of view that we've been going over around voice hearing and your own story and what you've been through and how you've been dealing with your experiences.
Okay, so my girls want to say that they've been singing Mona Lisa to me, which is their anthem song whenever I'm stressed and nervous. They've only been singing it in the last 4 years or so, because they used to always sing children's songs. And their repertoire has expanded in the last couple, well, children and theater. Their repertoire has expanded. I've been out for 5 or 6 years now, but I think it's really been only the last 4 years they sing Mona Lisa to me when I'm nervous. So I've been sung to. They want everybody to know that it was not an unanimous decision to come out. And that's a part of the story that I didn't offer. And they want you to know that.
Do they want to say more about that, about how it was not a unanimous decision?
They're squabbling amongst themselves right now, which they can kind of do like in a muffled way that I can't understand what they're saying. So that's what's happening right now. But for me, it's been the challenge of the change that comes with changing the status of our relationship. I think that was really intimidating for all of us, but especially them. So one of them was the dissenting vote. So it was 3-1. So I think it had a lot to do with change and being concerned about being left behind and not taken care of. That's pretty much it. But it's really important to our story that everybody know that it wasn't, that we didn't all just decide to do this, that it has continued to be a negotiating point. I think we're good with it now. But on some days we're not, I'm being told. But my male voice, wants the microphone, and he wants everybody to check out hearingvoicesusa.org and to find out more about why it's so important to be able to understand vastly unique experiences through many different perceptions and many different understandings, and to not cop out with the one way you think it might be, because you're missing a vital and creative and fluid journey that somebody else is on that they'd like to share with you.
That's wonderful. That's one of the reasons I do this work, is that it is about finding out more about who we are as people and spirits in this world. And what would you say to someone who wonders, well, wait a second, I kind of have these different parts of myself, they seem like different people, but they're inside of my head. Sometimes they're maybe outside, but I don't really know. Am I a voice here? How would you respond to someone who isn't sure if they're a voice here, who maybe has a similar but different kind of experience to the things that we've been talking about?
I guess I would respond with that's entirely up to you. I think self-defining one's experience is really, really part and parcel to the Hearing Voices movement. I would also say that if you're not really sure, you should sit with yourself and do some self-exploration around that, because it will be you that kind of determines whether or not you're a voice hearer. Most voice hearers are pretty sure that they are. Like most of us that have voices outside of ourselves know it. So a lot of people will say, okay, then it's probably an internal voice because it's just, you know, part of myself, or an internal voice because that's usually how it feels to me. But I don't think that excludes us from a Hearing Voices group. I know a lot of people that don't identify as voice hearers, but have ongoing dialogue with what they consider their inner voices, and they find Hearing Voices groups really supportive environments to figure out what that is for them and how to be more supportive of themselves and compassionate about their own journeys. So I'm not sure when it all comes out in the wash that identifying yourself as a voice hearer is as important as it is being an active participant in your own journey. But that, again, that's my perspective, and I think other folks would say something different. But there are days when I wonder if I'm a voice hearer, because I hear companions, and I wonder why other folks don't. Maybe, you know, everybody else should be labeled something. I'm just me.
Lisa, we are just about out of time. So give us information about how people can get in touch with you, and also how they can find out more about the Hearing Voices movement in general, and also about the 2017 Hearing Voices Congress in Boston.
Sure. The best email address to find me at will be with the Western Mass RLC. You can find me at lisa@westernmassrlc.org. And to find out more about the Hearing Voices USA, we are at hearingvoicesusa.org. There's great resources there, calendar of events, group locator mechanism, so you can find out if there's groups hanging out near you. And all the latest news that is happening in the U.S. and internationally is somehow linked at that address.
Lisa Forestell, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Lisa Forestell. She's Director of Community Development at the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. Lisa is a voice hearer. She's a Hearing Voices Group facilitator and trainer, and also a facilitator and trainer of the Alternatives to Suicide groups. And she's an activist and psychiatric survivor. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall, and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.